Hello, captives, and a belated Happy New Year for 2024. My name is Richard Kutcher, and this is episode 98 of the Global Captive Podcast, supported by the EY Global Captive Network. We have an InsurTech themed episode for you for the next 50 minutes or so, featuring three professionals all working in and passionate about technology in the commercial insurance industry, and of course a strong interest and connection with captives. Later in the episode, I'll be speaking to two West Coast guys, Joshua Pyle, Vice President and Head of Risk and Captive Management at Boost, and Cameron MacArthur, Founder and CEO at AI Insurance Inc. But first, to give us his perspective on where the InsurTech market has come from and where it is heading, is Matthew Grant, CEO at London headquartered Instec, a network bringing together innovators across the insurance and risk management sectors around the world. We will hear from Matthew now and again at the end of the pod, where we discuss the growing opportunity for captives to embrace technology innovations directly. So, Matthew, welcome onto the Global Captive Podcast.
It's a great pleasure to be here, Richard, and it's always enjoyable and sometimes a challenge to be answering the questions, not asking them.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I enjoyed that challenge when I came onto your podcast probably about a year ago now, wasn't it? Was it the start of the year or end of the year? I can't quite remember exactly when it was. But yeah, I've been listening to the InsurTech podcast for since the beginning of COVID, and really love the content that you guys put out there, and highly recommend. People are particularly intrigued by this conversation to look up InsurTech and check out the podcast as well. We'll put some links in the episode show notes. So just start off, Matthew, so we can get to know you. For those who don't, can you tell us a bit about your background in risk and insurance prior to your involvement with InsurTech?
Yeah, I actually did a degree in engineering, and my second job, but my main job was working in a risk management consultancy that was a spin-off from looking at nuclear risk. And actually through that, I got involved in risk management directly. The high point of that was I did the emergency planning, or updated emergency planning, for Dounreay nuclear power stations. So fortunately, they've had no incidents there. But that was my experience working with risk managers and the whole risk management industry.
Fantastic. And then, so what interested you then in joining InsurTech in 2017, I believe? And had you been keen on the technology and innovation side of the insurance world?
So I spent about 25 years in catastrophe modeling after my initial foray into risk management, working with organizations, building the tools to assess the risk from major catastrophes. And that was a really good insight to how insurance companies could really benefit from data and analytics, but also some of the challenges of actually moving from the old way of doing things into the new way. And back in 2016, it was really just the beginning of what was then the kind of InsurTech movement. I think the term had only just been coined. And it was really intriguing to see in London, but and also globally, people coming together to talk about the businesses they were building using technology that was new, scalable. And it seemed like a good time to build a business to support those companies and try and make some money out of it.
Fantastic. So it's been a fast growing organization since then, particularly, and I've enjoyed all of the InsurTech events I've attended and been lucky to speak at a couple as well. Can you tell us a bit about the profile of the organization InsurTech today and your kind of mission and purpose?
Yeah, I mean, our mission is really to bring together people from both sides, the buyers and the sellers of technology. And actually, I'd increasingly add in your audience, that actually risk managers, who are recognizing that, yeah, that there is no way back, if you like. I mean, digital is here to stay. There are lots of benefits from moving to a digital working environment. And so helping the insurance companies understand thematically, really, you know, what are all the technologies out there, which ones are actually making a difference and can they start to bring into their business? And then on the other side, helping the companies that are building, not as new companies, but ones that have been around, you know, for 20, 30, 40 years or longer, but are actually building new solutions for insurers and corporates and risk managers with data and analytics.
And you mentioned a little while ago about kind of when kind of the insurtech term started emerging, and we started seeing the first insurtechs emerging. But I think we agree that sometimes it can feel like a bit of an undefined term at times, insurtech. How do you define it today? What makes an insurtech firm, and maybe what doesn't make an insurtech firm?
Yeah, we could spend the whole podcast talking about that. It's a bit of a moving target as well, because certainly back, you know, what, 8-10 years ago, it really was around those startups we saw coming in. You know, a lot of those companies were getting funding, quite significant in some cases, $10-100 billion or pounds. But essentially, the essence of it, they were looking at ways, and still are, of using data analytics technology to, you know, hopefully improve the customer experience, first of all, credit efficiencies for insurers, and open up new ways of covering what we often talk about as the insurance protection gap. So things that are too difficult to insure, just unattractive for insurers. And the idea, if you get better data on those, then they become more insurable. I'd say insurtech today tends to be falling into two categories. So one is technology-enabled risk carriers or risk distributors. So yeah, the full stack carrier or an MGA, or an organization that's building the technology that is being sold to those companies. So you've got two different types of organization. I think generally it's still considered to be a companies that have been around probably now for 15 years. So probably not, you know, many of those are no longer startups. I'm not quite sure you can still justify the term startup after 15 years. But yeah, that's probably the best working definition to use.
Yeah, and we've seen, particularly interested in the captive space, we've seen, you know, so many tech-enabled, you know, full-stack MGAs, you know, utilizing their technology, setting up their own insurance vehicles, setting up captive vehicles, wanting to engage with captives. That's where I'm starting to see a huge kind of crossover and involvement between the insurtech world and the captive world, is actually that MGA space is getting really, really interesting. You've obviously come across hundreds, if not more, insurtech firms and ideas. And as we know, particularly maybe in that phase 10 or so years ago, the majority of those ideas might have not got much further, might have just stayed an idea. But how do you assess the quality and value within the insurtech landscape today in London, but also perhaps globally?
Yeah, I mean, thousands really of companies out there in different forms. I'd say the early days, you go back 10 years ago, a lot of the focus was more around the personal lines, so improving the way we'd all personally think about buying insurance. That it's changed in some areas. I mean, the UK is a little bit ahead there anyway. I'm listening to somebody else, a very interesting podcast about somebody in the US, but their experience of buying insurance, and it really could have been 10, 15 years ago. That unfortunately hasn't changed much. But where we are seeing the bigger change, I'd say, is in the sort of small, medium businesses, and then starting to move into specialty where, as we all know, there's a lot of costs of trying to, for example, assess buildings, do surveys, expensive to send people out. So on the one hand, we're seeing better ways to be able to assess or access information about buildings. And then we're starting to see more efficiency now around how data is being exchanged. So sort of, I mean, I guess one of the ironies of looking back over the last 10 years, the two areas that are probably strongest just now are pet insurance and people wanting to be able to extract data from PDFs. We can talk a bit about generative AI in a minute, but you know, it's probably not what people thought the dream of insurtech would reveal in 10 years' time. But the reality is that's what insurers, you know, and also risk managers, your buyers, your captives want, is how do I get that information into my organization quickly and can spend my time assessing information, not, you know, rekeying or trying to figure out where I find the data I need to make a decision.
Yeah, as you know, as you're very much aware of from speaking to the risk managers a lot over the last 12 to 18 months, that is the major gripe they all have with the commercial insurance market. You know, put captives aside, that is just what every risk insurance manager is struggling with, and they're kind of praying. And I think we are starting to see more and more of those solutions, which should make things easier. I mean, you touched on a couple of them there, but what are the kind of major problems or challenges that insurtechs are successfully and effectively addressing right now?
Well, to me, it comes down to this question of what is the biggest problem for you just now. So if you sort of take the perspective of an insurtech talking to an insurance company, what is the biggest problem just now? And if you talked a bit about that, call it simplicity, but this the sort of efficiency of moving data through, that's a major one. Data, of course, is always going to be there itself as a way of making decisions. And there are certain areas, you know, such as when you look at property, that are still surprising to me, actually, really challenging. And in fact, we actually had, I think you were at the event, actually, a fascinating panel of risk managers. And this, the issue is, you know, the combination of large corporations that either have the data themselves and are actually doing a better job at getting it, but when the insurers request it, the insurers themselves don't really know what they're going to do with it. They just sort of feel they've got to ask for data. So you've got this problem, I suspect, which is the data is starting to make its way into insurer, but they don't quite know what to do with it. And then you've got another problem, which I think is really interesting from the convergence of insurtech into the broader world that you deal with, which is I actually don't know what I want to know about my properties. If I'm a large company with 50, 100, 1,000 sites, it's actually quite difficult to keep on top of what you've got. Don't always know what it's made of. You know, all these things that can have quite a big impact on loss, particularly when you think about things like, you know, the change of climate and flooding. So there's a, you know, challenge and an opportunity to actually be able to identify reliable information and get it into the workflow much more efficiently and cost effectively for both for insurers and for their clients.
To turn that question around, are there any areas where you know and people have, you know, pointed out and highlighted real challenges in the insurance market where we haven't yet seen insurtechs come forward with a solution? Do you think there is kind of a, not a holy grail, but a big opportunity for something else that needs to be fixed that hasn't quite been dealt with yet?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. So innovation doesn't really happen in a vacuum. It really only happens when there's been a big shift in people's awareness of the risk. So that's, yeah, back in my background, 25 years ago, major hurricanes in the US, windstorms in the UK, earthquakes. That's what really shifted the move to catastrophe modeling, because it's no longer good enough to make a sort of estimate on the back of an envelope. So that changes things. Regulation, when the market or the regulators decide they need to get more information, and we're starting to see this quite significantly with climate change, then people start to pay attention. You can't avoid the regulator, and that's what drives change. So those are two things. But it also means without that kind of big shift or a big major event, then people get less focused on the data. So cyber is an interesting example, because back to my point about, you know, more data enables insurers to find solutions for their problem. You know, cyber clearly bigger and bigger risk, but the cyber market tends to be quite volatile depending on what kind of losses there have been and how many competitors have been in there. And lacking, yeah, I'd be careful when I say this, but lacking a big catastrophic cyber risk which goes across multiple companies, yeah, people start to feel that maybe they can write a bit more business, not quite so concerned about aggregations. So there's a bit of a challenge in that. And I'd say the other big difficulty just now is, I'd say there's a big gap, or still a big gap, in this ability to underwrite and insure areas that previously haven't been insurable, because the data is still new, and insurers, you know, prefer to rate based on experience. But if you're starting to, you know, look at new areas, you know, cyber is the obvious one, but you've got areas such as IP now, and then the whole area related to liability for using generative AI, and, you know, what does that mean in terms of copyright? There is no data. And so the difficulty there is trying to convince an underwriter to allocate capacity to write a risk or to support an MGA when they have to rely on the models and the analytics, and they can't, you know, they can't back it up by recent or historic loss data.
Yeah. So on I think one of the themes, again, maybe this is an outdated opinion now, but obviously one of the themes of the insurtech journey has been maybe the large carriers, large brokers, a big kind of those guys with big legacy systems still working off lots of spreadsheets and, you know, physical files and drawers and things, that they've been slow to embrace technology and importantly implement technology. Is that still the case? Do you think those big insurance monsters are kind of coming round to not only knowing that they need to implement more efficient systems, but actually getting around to doing it?
Well, I came across this great phrase that absolutely, to me, identifies the challenge, which is a lot of insurers are still running off these diesels in the basement. So they've got these legacy systems. I'd say every leading insurance company, most insurance companies today, will have a board that recognizes they need to move digital. But then it's kind of, how do you do it? So you've got your kind of engine chucking away in the basement, and then someone brings you a new, you know, highly analytical API-enabled solution, and you just can't connect the two together. So there's a big shift, I'd say, in terms of other themes happening to these platforms that are essentially, you know, like the connectors between the old systems, the engines that the insurers have got, and the new ways of doing things. And increasingly, I mean, it's like every industry, I mean, even down to how we use our iPhones. if you've got a, platform that you can access multiple different choices analytics data on, you're much more likely to go to the platform and then just buy what you want through the platform than in insurance terms or risk managers terms. They're not going to negotiate with 30 different suppliers of data. That would take up their entire life. They'd leave no time to do everything else. So the thing that is encouraging, I'd say, is these larger, more historic organizations on the technology side that start to see the benefits and actually collaboration around bringing in third parties that have got data and analytical tools.
And you and I discussed a lot during the lockdowns that maybe historically the InsurTech focus has been very much on supporting and selling products to the commercial insurers and the brokers. You mentioned, of course, personal lines maybe first up, but even to the big kind of corporate insurers and corporate brokers, but maybe less focused on the end user, the insurance buyer that you've touched on a few times in this conversation. I know this is something that you've been working a lot on at InsurTech. Do you see a lot of effective implementation of tech solutions directly with clients, or is that an area that increasingly the InsurTech world is focused on?
InsurTech world recognizes, frankly, there's a necessity of expanding beyond insurers to buy their products. I mean, Provisico is one example I know quite well, who are providing flood forecasting tools for short-term flood forecasting, much higher resolution than you could get from the environmental agency. And they're working directly with the companies, not quite personal lines, but to provide those tools that are all part of this risk management, predict and prevent solutions out there. And so I think everyone wins in this scenario. You've got an InsurTech that is working with insurers on one hand, but also working with the large corporates and the risk managers, then you get a much more efficient flow of information in there. So that's very encouraging. And I think also the other thing that is linking into that is there's more companies coming in from outside of insurance. I haven't traditionally worked in insurance, and now I'm starting to see opportunities to provide analytics to the customer more broadly.
So that is the first half of my conversation with Matthew, and we will be back with him after hearing from our next two guests. First up is Cameron MacArthur, founder and CEO at AI Insurance Inc., which may be familiar to those who regularly attend captive conferences across the United States. Cameron is particularly passionate about language learning models, but realized more than 5 years ago there was other technology steps needed to be taken with captives before we can start getting too clever with AI. Cameron shares the AI insurance journey, but also his wider observations and views on the potential for tech and AI in captives. So Cameron, great to finally have you onto the Global Captive Podcast.
Yeah, about time. It's been literally a few years too late, but maybe not too late. It's great. Great to be here. I really appreciate it, Richard.
Yeah, we met a good few years ago. I think I was still at Captive Review when we first met each other, and I've been threatening this day for the last 4 or 5 years ever since then. So great to have you on, and great to have you on particularly on this episode, which is InsurTech themed, and you are kind of one of the first companies that comes to mind when I talk about, when I think about InsurTechs in captive. So Cameron, before we dive into AI insurance and your general views on the InsurTech world, what is your background and how did you get interested in and come to be working in the captive market?
So my background is I did some research in human computer interaction and then went and worked at IBM as a cognitive software engineer. And got exposure to captives because I was working at IBM in East Cambridge. And fun fact about East Cambridge, it's the highest concentration of hospitals per square foot on the planet. So because of that, there's a lot of doctors. And because of that, there's a lot of medical malpractice insurance. So my first exposure to captives was actually through CRICO, the RRG, just like learning about their existence and the whole concept of these really small insurance companies. Because obviously as a consumer, right, you just think about what you see on the TV as insurance, right? Your State Farms and your Progressives and your Geicos, and kind of missing this whole iceberg under the water that, is the insurance world that we know of. So yeah, got exposure to the concept of a risk retention group, specifically in MedMal, and the amount of pain they experienced in setting reserves and essentially predicting the costs of their indemnity payments. And that's what kicked off the whole company and got me into the captive space, was writing a machine learning algorithm to predict the cost of a claim in medical malpractice.
Yeah, and I really like your iceberg analogy. I think that's a good way to put, you know, the commercial market, but also the captive world as well. Before we get on to a bit more details about your business then, and this is a quite a loaded open question, but what's your general view on the adoption and embrace of technology in the captive space? And I'm interested to know if you think we are light years behind where we should or could be.
Yeah, I mean, if we're being candid, which I know between the two of us, we always are, Richard, I don't think anyone would disagree or think otherwise if you said insurance tends to lag behind finance when it comes to technology adoption. The insurance space, you know, is about 5 to 10 years behind where banks are as far as technology adoption. Captives, I think, are in an interesting position because I think they're in that same bucket as the rest of insurance and have historically not invested in technology because they've always felt, oh, it's too big for us. You know, like we're not in the technology bucket, because technology used to be a pretty large investment, right? You used to be a company and you'd say, oh, we're going to go buy computers, or we're going to go invest in software. And that's a multi-$100,000 investment that takes years, right? Often millions of dollars. And with the advent of the cloud and SaaS software, I think that barrier to entry has really, really dropped, right? Even with things as simple as like Google Sheets and online Excel and things like that, the accessibility of these technologies has really moved farther down. And I think there's candidly a regulatory forcing function here too on the captive side, which is that, you know, you're at the end of the day, you are running an insurance company, right? And with the pressure we're seeing from the IRS, different regulatory agencies, they're saying, hey, look like a duck, quack like a duck kind of thing. If you're running an insurance company, it should act and run like an insurance company. And so there are a lot, you know, there's the data model security law that was put in place by the NAIC that a lot of states are adopting that forces things like multi-factor authentication to get to your data. And, you know, if your data is an Excel spreadsheet on someone's Windows XP desktop, that's not multi-factor, right? And so I think those forcing functions are pushing captives forward. And so we're certainly seeing more of it because captives are smaller, have the opportunity to move more quickly. So I would say the rate that captives are moving to technology is faster than the larger insurance market, which makes sense also because so many of these captives are connected to parent companies, right? Who, of course, they have the almost innovative requirement of, you know, they have larger businesses that are constantly at the exposure of, you know, innovate, beat your competitors or die. So I think they're bringing that attitude into captives of, oh, it makes sense to them that they would need to be innovating in this area.
And I think this is a small subsection perhaps, but I also think, and I've said this a few times before, that particularly captives which are owned by very, very large companies who have quite a lot of sway and leverage in the commercial market, actually we see some of those captives almost dragging their commercial market partners along with them to have a more efficient, technologically enabled approach to their insurance buying, insurance procurement processes. Because, you know, a very, very large company can say to their insurance partners, well, you know, join us on this new platform or you're not on our program, we'll go somewhere else. And we've seen that a few times in a few individual use cases where a captive has kind of embraced a new way of doing things and has took the market along with them. And that's probably not actually restricted to InsurTech. That could be other things, other ways of doing things as well. But I've certainly seen that as an InsurTech example.
In my experience, it's always the folks that are in least need of technology and innovation that are constantly pushing, right? Like whenever we talk to folks about tech in any context, it's always the people that are sort of in the best position that are asking where they can push the envelope and how they can be more innovative. And I'm not surprised to hear that on the large company side too, that the folks that are most innovative are kind of in least need of innovation.
So tell us about AI Insurance then, which is your company. How did it come about? What problems or challenges are you trying to solve?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, the inception point was writing that machine learning algorithm to predict the cost of a claim in medical malpractice. So humans are pretty bad at setting reserves, candidly. Over the course of a med mal claim, they'll change the expected total indemnity about 7 to 10 times. And at the end of the entire claim, which is about 5 to 7 years on average, folks will be a little bit more than $100,000 off. So about 48% median of like 107K. And that's the last guess. So the very last guess, right before the claim closes, humans are, you know, 50% off in the best cases. And a lot of times, about 15% of the time, they'll actually pay more in defense costs than they pay in indemnity. So you'll pay, you know, 100 grand to settle your claim and you'll pay 350K in attorney fees. You're like, oh my gosh, if I knew I was going to give this guy 100 grand, I would have given him 200 grand 6.5 years ago and saved myself 150 grand in defense costs. So that's what kicked off the whole company. And we started even back in 2018, everyone's, you know, oh my gosh, AI, you know, it's the hot thing. But there was this cart before the horse problem where, you know, I remember we literally had a conversation with a risk retention group where they said, great, you know, we want the AI. Here's my money. Give me the AI. And we said, you know, where is your claims data? And they said, once a quarter, I fly to Orange County. I sit down with my TPA. He opens up a filing cabinet and a card table. And we spread the claims out over the card table. And that's how we review our claims.
Wow.
And I was completely uninitiated to insurance at the time, right? So I'm coming from a tech company and I was like, what? You run a business that does $10 million in revenue and you don't know how many people are suing you right now? And they were like, oh, that's just how it is. And so it was very clear early on that we were not in a position to give people AI. Right? Like I can cut your costs in half just by getting you on the internet. So there was this cart before the horse problem of why do captives, risk retention groups, small programs not have software? Why are they not running these organizations on software? And it came down to a couple things. The first was cost, right? There are existing softwares, but they cost $1 million a month, right? They're trying to sell to State Farm or Geico or Progressive, right? So they have no interest in a company that does 2 million in premium, right? Or 5 million in premium. And then the second was, even if they were interested, captives and risk retention groups in particular have this very interesting fragmentation problem, right? Where the whole company might be run by 5 or 6 vendors. And even if one of them got software, a broker says, well, I don't want to pay $1,500 a month for this TPA to get a login to my system. So I'll just send them a spreadsheet. Right. And the TPA says, well, I don't want to pay $1,500 a month for this captive manager or this, you know, broker or program manager, you know, to have a login to my system. And so you get this very fragmented ecosystem where everyone just sends each other spreadsheets and they can't actually work together. And so those were the two problems that we set out to solve.
So what role then are you playing today in the captive value chain, and what kind of business is your ideal or typical client?
So we make the software for running a captive insurance company or risk retention group, and we serve as the connective tissue in sort of a hub and spoke model. So we don't charge for logins, which means that if, let's say, the program manager of a risk retention group gets access to AI Insurance, then the TPA and the broker and the captive manager all get access for free. And those permissions are controlled. So the captive manager can just log in and download what they need, and TPA can handle claims and it's not going to cost them anything. You bring everybody onto the same software and onto the same place and permission everyone to their role, and everything happens more seamlessly. And that's the case whether that role is inside the company or outside of the company. And then the second thing that I always put, you know, as an and is, once you've been on AI Insurance for some time, then we have all of your data end to end, right? From digital application through to rating, underwriting, you know, finding issuance and claims, you can start to do some pretty cool machine learning things with that data. So we have three models. We have an invoice audit model. So on the claim side, you can just forward your invoices and we'll read them and parse them and then audit them against your defense counsel guidelines, all using large language models. We can do our, you know, old faithful indemnity prediction. And then the third one is not live yet, but probably, you know, Q3, Q4 of next year, we'll be rolling out adjusting credits and debits. So we can actually look at how you underwrite and say, oh, this is a 5% credit. It really should be a 2.4% credit.
Really interesting. Yeah, I was going to ask you a bit more detail about the broader potential of AI in a second. But in terms of that kind of client base, do you have an ideal or typical client, or are your clients, in terms of captives, are they kind of very varied in size? And you mentioned RRGs quite a bit, presumably different captive types as well.
So I would say a risk retention group is often our ideal client. We also work with some TPAs. So I would say a large TPA that does like cat claims, not really a perfect fit, but a small boutique TPA handling claims in the liability space, like basic claims, tends to be a pretty perfect fit for AI insurance.
So obviously your passion, Cameron, before captives, right? Your passion was AI, and I imagine still is AI. And we talked at the very beginning about, you know, how far behind technology curve are captives generally. And we see a lot of thought leadership articles and written articles about, you know, AI is going to transform captives and AI is going to transform insurance. And I'm not saying it isn't, right? I'm not saying it's not going to be, but I think you're one of the few people who's probably quite well placed to actually provide a decent opinion on this. So what is the potential for AI and captives? Like, what are the kind of things it could really, even if it can't do it today, it could do in the future? Could it be a massive disruptor for how captives are run, how captives are utilized, or just is it purely about the operations could just get a lot smarter and a lot more efficient?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, these large language models are exceptionally good at anything to do with reading and writing. So imagine there's a lot of that in the insurance process. A couple big things that come to mind for me are, you know, and these again are things that are maybe not right here, but will be coming soon. Like on the claim side, you get a claim. Is there coverage? The ability to, you know, read an entire insurance policy and understand the nuances of it and determine whether the claim that just came in has coverage. I think that kind of reading comprehension is something that large language models are really good at. The same goes for writing, right? Like drafting endorsements and policy document changes, I think are pretty much game, set, match for large language models. Obviously, a lot of the kind of risk management components, right, around like better underwriting and better reserving, I think we'll see a lot of changes there. Yeah, and probably the communication side on the more consumer-facing market, you know, captives and RRGs, because they tend to be more commercial, it tends to be a little bit more white glove. So I think we'll see some of that kind of trickle down of, oh, you know, this person doesn't need to talk to someone, they can just talk to an AI. But I still do think that, you know, a lot of this client-focused work of captive managers and brokers is going to persist in our segment of the space, because even if people could get their answers through AI, you know, there's always the competitive advantage to being a human, and humans like talking to humans. So I think that kind of relationship component, especially in the commercial market, is going to stay.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm certainly not one of those that thinks AI is going to take over all of insurance. But I just think there is so much, as you've touched upon, so much low hanging fruit in things that can be made a lot more efficient and a lot quicker. And I'm not someone that has to deal with this stuff day to day. I just hear about it from risk managers and from brokers about the pain of some of the way things are done. Just lastly then, Cameron, and I think you've touched on this in terms of what's coming next then, you know, what's your ultimate ambitions for AI insurance? Where do you want to take this platform? Are there other areas that you've maybe not explored in great detail yet, but you can see that there might be value in addressing?
The long-term plan is, of course, to be the platform that all captives, risk retention groups, and small programs are running on. There's some interesting stuff coming in the next year. So I mentioned the using AI to help with underwriting. I think another thing that is pretty ripe for disruption by large language models is all of the application management. So you hear from basically everybody in the, you know, program space and RRG space that, you know, they have an application process, but 70-80% of the time they just get emailed a PDF, right? Or some other insurance company's application, and someone just says, hey, you want the business or not, right? And then they're manually digging through this application. And we expect that we'll be able to eliminate that pain pretty soon. We're already using large language models to read other parts of the insurance process, like the invoices that I mentioned. So I expect in the next, you know, 6 to 12 months that we'll be able to say, hey, just drag and drop in whatever you got, and we'll read the whole application and fill it all out to match your application. And then, you know, maybe let you or the broker know, hey, here are these four questions that weren't in that CNA application you got. But I'm pretty excited about that, because, you know, when you mention people's pain, that seems to be this consistent, persistent pain across all of insurance.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of pain across all of insurance. I think we can agree on that. And having, you know, spent a lot of time talking to different insurtechs and people interested in insurtech and captives over the last few years, yeah, that is definitely what a lot of people are focusing on. It's just removing a lot of the burdensome administration. It sounds like you're certainly on the way to doing that, if not already doing that. So Cameron, great to have you on the podcast for the first time. Been a real pleasure, and hopefully we'll see you on the circuit next year.
Yeah, sounds like a plan. Thanks so much, Richard. Appreciate your time.
Thank you to Cameron, and great to finally have him on the pod. Next up is Joshua Pyle, who today is Vice President and Head of Risk and Captive Management at Boost, but has previously worked on all sides of the commercial insurance market, including as a Senior Director and Head Actuary at DoorDash, which included being a director of its Hawaii domiciled captive. So Josh discusses the wider tech opportunities for captives, but also brings us up to speed on his role and the aims of Boost. So Josh, welcome onto the Global Captive Podcast.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Yeah, great to have you on. I've been following the Boost journey from afar, and so it would be great to get you on, particularly with your captive background and your captive role. So let's start with your background. Can you tell us a bit about your kind of insurance and your captive background prior to joining Boost?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have been an actuary for about 17 years now. Started one in what I would call big insurance. So worked at Liberty Mutual, Allianz, AAA, across the gamut of actuarial functions, pricing, reserving, predictive modeling. Switched up a little bit, moved into cybersecurity and cyber catastrophe modeling at Symantec and CyberCube. And then most recently before Boost, I built and led the risk and insurance team at DoorDash, where I also served on the board of directors of their captive. And that was kind of a good segue for joining Boost about 3 months back now as their head of risk and captive management.
Great. So first of all, you're an actuary, which means you actually really do understand insurance and don't just talk about it like lots of us. And you're one of the people that actually makes it happen. But also that's really interesting. You've got that kind of full experience of the commercial market, the client side, and then obviously the cyber stuff is really interesting too. So before we get into kind of some of the Boost and InsurTech chats, obviously you've had multiple perspectives of the commercial market and the captive market and how they're utilized. What are your general observations of the captive market as it stands today and how they're used and how they're utilized?
So I do see an uptick. I know it was growing pretty quickly for a while and then seemed to have plateaued for a bit. But more recently, with a hard market across so many lines, I do think there's an increased uptick in captive utilization. I also think there's probably an increased flexibility in how they're utilized. I see a lot of new and emerging lines, maybe some, I don't know if experimentation is the right word, a lot of flexibility in terms of what lines are offered, seeing some cyber and a lot of D&O, employee benefits, crypto, a lot of diversification across lines of business. And I think it's kind of a creative time to be utilizing a captive right now. I also think there's a general trend from offshore utilization to onshore. Probably some of those more traditional benefits that you would get offshore have been minimized over time, and there's kind of an increasing likelihood to adopt an onshore domicile.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We certainly see that. So how much room then do you think there is for disruption, technological innovation? How much room remains for that in the commercial insurance market and the captive market?
I think it can go both ways. I think captive utilization can actually spur innovation. And by that, I mean, captives traditionally are used for those new and emerging lines or lines where you can't find capacity. So companies that are doing something innovative or new have that means to support what they're doing. At the same time, I think technology can benefit insurance as well. So I really would think of a couple of instances. One would be risk interpretation and understanding. So we're in this new era of big data equals more advanced analytics equals better modeling. So coming from the gig/commercial auto domain at DoorDash, thinking about things like telematics and how advanced analytics and maybe even autonomous vehicles or robot delivery can help with route-based optimization and kind of build that understanding of risk. And then using some of the tools that we've probably all been playing around with in the last couple of months, generative AI to help understand policy language, how forms and contracts are written and understood, how liability is divided across lines of business, thinking about things like silent cyber, and again, autonomous vehicles too is another example, gives that understanding of risk that then plays into captive utilization. So captives both spur innovation, but I think this new technology allows us to do better with optimal risk transfer into captives as well.
Let's hear a bit about Boost. So how did Boost come to be interested in captives? And could you expand a bit on what your role is there regarding head of kind of insurance and captives?
So Boost is, as a core offering, we generally say it's insurance in a box. And by that, I mean, we will do anything from product creation to filing to underwriting to pricing to claims management, match our partners with fronting carriers or reinsurance capacity. And so this is actually a launch that we made, I guess now it's been a month or two. It's a natural extension of that, where if our partners actually want to take risk onto their balance sheet, they can do that via a rent-a-cell. So via our own established cell captive. It establishes Boost as, at least to my knowledge, the only true end-to-end insurance ecosystem player, where if you want to build a product or deploy a product, we will do any part of that value chain. And this is a natural extension that allows those partners to participate in risk themselves. And my role really is to manage that captive entity and the partnerships that funnel into it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does, absolutely. So it's in terms of, you said, you know, some companies would have kind of an end-to-end solution. They could participate in some of the risk themselves. Who are those kind of clients, those target clients, and the type of businesses that you're keen to work with or the platform has been designed specifically for?
We work with a couple of different types of entities. So insurtech companies, embedded distribution partners, MGAs, basically anyone who wants to offer deploy an insurance product that maybe doesn't have a core insurance offering as their core business, we'll step in with those end-to-end capabilities and help them build that and deploy. So we do a number of lines today, a lot of cyber, startup management liability, pet health, parental leave, a little bit of crypto, obviously building out a few other lines as well. But what's unique is if we've built it and you want to offer what we've built, great. Otherwise, we're actually willing to come to the table and build something from scratch. And it is today primarily commercial. We have a little bit of personal, and it's US focused today, but that's not to say it will stay that way forever. A lot of times it's just a conversation around what that looks like, ramp up time, lines of business, rollout plans, growth plans, and just get a sense of, you know, resource requirement to build that and deploy that. But we're pretty flexible and open with working with different types of businesses across different lines of business.
We'll come on to the sponsored captives but specifically in a second. But obviously, there's lots of sponsored captives out there, lots of people offering kind of rent-to-sell facilities. But presumably, you guys have some underlying technology play here, which you think makes the model and the product that Boost has kind of particularly attractive. Can you talk us through that?
Just the integration with what the so-called core or original Boost offering was is pretty unique. Again, I think it's the only company that offers that end-to-end insurance ecosystem. And so everything is white labeled, offered via API on the product side. And just that very tech forward platform allows us an integration point. I know there are other rent-a-captive solutions out there, but there's nothing that really ties in cleanly with the first part of that question. How are these products built? How are they deployed? And Boost really is a unique offering in that it kind of combined the two and offers customers access to a one-stop shop or the end-to-end platform that they wouldn't get otherwise.
So Boost Re is the sponsored cell captive, which is in North Carolina. What attracted Boost to North Carolina as a domicile? Because as we know, there's so much choice now, right? Particularly if you're staying onshore in the United States.
Yeah, there really is. Historically, I think you've seen a lot of Vermont, Hawaii, nothing against those domiciles at all. I think there is a lot of choice. You probably more recently have seen a lot of Utah, a lot of North Carolina. North Carolina is actually the fastest growing in the U.S., It's a good regulatory environment, very business-friendly environment, and there's really a blossoming ecosystem of talent around the captive environment there. So you'll see a lot of legal, accounting, actuarial, just captive management expertise in that area. It was kind of a combination of all those. Time zone makes sense given the company, this talent ecosystem, and general favorable business operational environment.
Great. Well, Josh, it's been great to have you on the Global Captive Podcast, and hopefully we'll catch up again soon.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Josh, and it'll be good to see how both Boost and AI insurance develop and grow in the coming years. So let's get back then to Matthew Grant at Instech as we delve further into the potential synergies between the InsurTech world and captives. How about captives then in this area? Is the captive side of things an area you see an opportunity for greater collaboration with the InsurTech community? Because I think it's something that I kind of definitely get on my high horse about. Some captives are pretty serious insurance companies. They're not all of them. Some of them are monoline, but some are, you know, doing 40 or 50 lines of insurance and are probably looking for more technology in their own right rather than relying directly on the commercial market.
Yeah, definitely. And I certainly see a shift. I've been working 30, 35 years. Most of it insurance, you know, the companies I've worked for, we've from time to time looked at kind of your world, looked at the captives, looked at the corporate, see if they'd be interested in buying technology. And for large, most of the times the answer was no, they couldn't justify another funds. That's changing pretty significantly. Part of the way people were talking about InsurTech going back 8-10 years ago was companies coming in to disrupt the industry. I'd say in the war between insurers and disruptors, insurers won that. But what's interesting now is if you look at what the insurers' clients, the corporate buyers, are doing, my question is, are they going to be the disruptors? Because you know, one example, I was on a panel recently at the Onshore Energy Conference, but we were actually talking about offshore energy. And Hannah Arbo, who is the insurance director for the Copenhagen infrastructure company, they are investing and will have to insure $100 billion of renewables. A lot of that's wind farms, and that was $100 billion I checked. Mm. And the panel actually generally were quite frustrated with the response from insurers about understanding the fact that they themselves have got a very good awareness of their own risks. They've got good data, but the insurers are not able to, or the brokers are not able to construct programs that are actually giving them the cover they want at the price they want. And so back to your point, I do see that there is going to be more and more of a movement from what are increasingly sophisticated and well-financed suddenly you've got more access to budget, you know, risk managers, captives, you know, whether it's through a captive or some other vehicle, to actually identify ways to get coverage that is they're going to drive themselves rather than waiting for the insurers to offer it independently of their own organization and their own sort of awareness of their risks.
Yeah, that's absolutely the way I see it as well. And what particularly because of this hard market cycle, I think it's been brought much more into focus, is that, you know, captives for a long time, and this isn't particularly new, but it's certainly more common that captives want to operate almost as the underwriter of choice for the group. And it's almost like the captive is in the position where it can start thinking about setting the price it's willing to pay, and maybe the commercial market can then try and beat it if it wants to take that risk on. But to do that, of course, the insurance buyer, the captive, needs the tools, the analytical tools, the data to actually do that kind of underwriting and collect all that data. And that's where I see the big opportunity for some of these exciting insurtech firms to come in, whether it's across cyber or across natural catastrophe or other perils, and provide those tools to enable the captive to kind of take that confident position and willing to underwrite it with the support of the commercial market, but kind of being the lead in some way. And I think some of the people in your community definitely have the tools and the solutions to help that happen.
Yeah, they definitely. And I'm really encouraged by some of the actions I see being taken. We touched on Provisica. We've got a podcast coming out with them, and they have one of their clients, which is Donaldson Timber. And just talking to Mark, the risk manager, it's just really fascinating, an example of how, yeah, the risk manager of today is thinking. And he basically realized they had a site that had a flood risk to it, went out there and looked at what the most efficient way was to protect against the risks. You know, they basically invested in, I was going to say inflatable sandbags. I don't think that's quite right, but I think they're sandbags you can blow up. I don't think an inflatable sandbag would work too well. But anyway, they had flood protection equipment, and then they had to figure out what the risk was. And they ended up putting in sensors and working with Provisico. And he didn't give the exact number, but there's many times order of magnitude of potential saving. You know, if you do the protection versus have to go out and get the insurance, or you take the loss. And you're saying the business interruption cover, that covers you for the loss, but what happens to your clients? They've all gone if you come back a year later. And so it was for me, it was a really heartening story. It sort of goes back, I suppose, to the start of my career about how an individual at an organization that is not an insurance organization, but actually can combine the tools, the data, an unawareness of the cost, and make a difference, you know, to actually just do it. And that's really, really encouraging, I would say, for what we see from the corporate world.
So you mentioned the podcast coming up there. If people do want to find the InStep podcast, I presume we can find it on all good podcast apps and some bad ones as well.
Yeah, I haven't found the bad ones, but yeah, certainly InStep, InStech. It's on Spotify, it's on Apple. They should definitely Google your one, and Richard. It was fascinating for me actually to learn about the captive world, and I know I got a lot of really good feedback from people from that, and you've been good enough to be on stage as well, so you're definitely part of the glue that helps us pull together. I should also add in, we have Susie, our director of events, who actually spent 12 years at Emix, so we've got a sort of and of course, it's a bloodline, but you know, we've got some linkage in the family of AirMic and risk managers as well, which is very nice.
And outside of the podcast, Matthew, if people do want to find out more about InStech or get involved in your community, what's the best way to go about it? How can they engage?
We'd love to have them along. We're doing another event in March specifically aimed at risk managers. Risk managers get along free. It's in London. It's sort of middle of late afternoon. We don't have people on stage for very long, so it's always quite snappy. But and if anybody wants to contact me directly, and actually if anybody wants to talk about what they're doing, either on stage or even potentially in our podcast, I mean, I just find it fascinating talking to the real client. When we've been working in insurance so long, to actually remember that somebody out there actually is buying insurance is always quite important, and the stories are just tremendous. So yeah, I'd love to hear from anybody that's got a story, got a question, or would like to get a bit more involved. It'd be fantastic.
Great. Well, I'll put your details, if you're happy for me to, in the episode show notes, and the obviously link to the InStech site and the podcast. And Matthew, thank you so much for coming on to the Global Captive Podcast.
No, Richard, it's a pleasure, and we should invite you back in 2024 to get an update on what's happening in your world as well, and extend my knowledge of captives and risk management.
Absolutely happy to do that. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
Take care, stay well, and see you next time, captives.